Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. How are you guys doing?
Good. I'm
great.
Great. Thanks for your promptness. I had a note that Stephanie will be with us, but she will be traveling, so she's going to be on her cell and will be muted unless she just has something that she can't wait and hold back. She'll unmute, but she'll join us next time in terms of active discussion. Well, you you received the roadmap case study. You may have looked at the book of like 32 case studies. Any thoughts or questions? I know that's premature because we've only begun the first three steps of the roadmap, the ROA part. But any thoughts about doing the case study or any questions?
This is Grace.
Yeah, hey.
One question, by the way, Dave. We're not able, this is a tech question. I wasn't able to access the October 5th recording. So the tech needs to move the button, I guess, so that for the October 5th session, if we want it,
was it
we
not
can
there
ask.
Or could you not access it?
Pardon me?
Was it not there downloaded for playback, or could you not
There's only an outline of the date, but there's no, you know, like for the September 28th, there's like that line and a playback button, you know.
Okay. I haven't checked, and it may just be that Bill, the CTA IT guy, hasn't posted it. If you have any trouble or if you notice any delay, then just contact him directly.
How do we do that?
Bill at CoachTrainingAlliance.com.
Bill at CoachTraining. Is it the whole thing? CoachTrainingAlliance.com?
Yeah, the whole thing. I think they do that to dissuade you from sending an email because you got to tap out the whole thing. But Bill at CoachTrainingAlliance.com. For any kind of technical questions whatsoever, don't hesitate to ask him. He'll be very happy to do that.
Okay.
So thanks, Grace, for that.
Okay. I do have a little breakthrough that I'd like to share.
Please.
I remember last session we all seemed to have difficulty understanding or finding our own stories. Now, for me personally, at first when I started analyzing, well, what is my story, I seemed to go to that logical, conscious part, like, okay, this is what happened, you know, and it really isn't a bad story, you know, but last weekend I had experienced something that took me to like experiencing powerlessness. I was kind of quite bummed, actually. It was something, I was at lynda.com studying, you know, how to make a website. And I was feeling so overwhelmed, and I didn't realize how badly it made me feel until at night when I was trying to relax and I was still feeling bummed out. Then I asked myself, what was this all about? What am I feeling bad about? And so that feeling of a little child helpless against this huge world of technology, huge new world of, you know, surviving in this technological world. And so I asked myself, when did I first feel that? And it was really amazing because it took me to the time when I made a key decision about life, and that was when I was 8, when my mother died and my father couldn't take care of us. And so life became difficult. I obviously made a decision that, well, I was alone, then I'm going to have to fend for myself. Well, life is huge and overwhelming and hard and such a struggle. Growing up in poverty, I lacked certain, you know, privileges, and I was abandoned and loved and not enough. And I was really amazed that to have found my under story, my shadow story, and from there worked on psychologically reparenting my child, and then that's when I began to write the new story, you know. Because even though my situation had helped me to become a survivor, an overcomer, and an achiever, still it was like driving life with the brakes on, driving with a car with your brakes on, because the limiting beliefs were limiting, were making it hard, making life such a struggle, you know. So that was my breakthrough.
That's really huge, and you've already begun writing one roadmap case study, and I want to highlight a couple of things that I think are important as we just listened to Grace's story and the elements that I think might be helpful to listen to a client's story, because I think she very elegantly and very openly, and I appreciate you sharing so much, and it really makes a difference in terms of the benefit that we get when each of you are so open and share very specific things that are very meaningful to you, because this is exactly what you'll be doing with clients as well. One thing that she asked, or the recognition here, although not in these words, but what is the age of this conversation? When she recognized an entire experience, an entire set of experiences, she recognized that the age of that conversation was maybe 8, maybe even a little bit earlier than that. So, in other words, she recognized a state change. Now, we're going to spend all of Module 4 and Week 6, I think, on mastering states of mind, because that is huge in coaching. Because in terms of a state change, as she mentioned, and mastering that, a feeling always triggers a state change. So it instantaneously boots up a whole software program, which is a state of mind. And all the content that she mentioned about being overwhelmed, recognizing that it was an earlier conversation, feeling alone, an earlier experience, that's all the content of that software program. And you can't move from one program, from one state of mind to another. You have to get grounded and centered first. It's a two-step process, and we're going to look at very specific ways to do that, and I have a very simple system of doing that I think you're going to find very useful with clients, and I don't want to get ahead because we need a context for it, but suffice it to say here that your state of mind determines the meaning you attach to something, and the meaning you attach determines your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very simple process, though it's not simple in experience at all. So since your state of mind determines the meaning you attach, and the meaning you attach determines your behavior, regulation of state of mind becomes, I believe, the most predominant success strategy that we have and that we have to help our clients with. And think about an example. You're at home with a partner, have a great dinner, or relaxing, enjoying a glass of wine. You hear a noise in the backyard. If you do register it, which you probably even don't notice it, then, you know, it doesn't even cause you to stray from the conversation. Next night, you're home alone. You've just finished Criminal Minds. It's Wednesday night, by the way. Don't ask me how I know. And you hear the same noise in the backyard, and you're alert and vigilant and wondering what it is, wanting to check it out. Same stimulus, but the meaning that you attach is determined by your state of mind. So that's why, as we listen to our clients, state always comes first, then strategy and story. So what that means is that when we're listening to a client may be upset or preoccupied or worried, all of those are states of mind. So what we want to do is resonate empathically with that client's experience, just as a simple initial resonance, so that we establish a common ground and can move ahead together. Then the client feels understood and is able to regulate just in that process, to get centered and grounded where they have access to all of their states of mind and all the information in it. And a simple empathic resonance would be to say something like, whatever the situation is, I understand how overwhelming that felt to you. Or, you know, I get how preoccupying this can be for you. Just to be understood puts you on common ground, then you can proceed together with that. So that's a great illustration, and we're going to look more closely at how to do that when we look at states of mind. So, Grace, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks again for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Other thoughts or comments? Anybody else want to check in with any wins or progress notes? Or just say hi. Anybody?
I'm here today.
This is Emmy.
This is Emmy and Nick.
Welcome.
I've been having problems. I'm fine. I had problems with my internet last week, but
yeah.
I think I corrected.
You sound next door right now, so that's great.
Yeah, thanks.
any questions or comments or anything you'd like us to talk about before we move into the material today? Or any questions or reflections on the roadmap case study? Any thoughts about that or questions about it? Remember, it can be on you or a client. And I wouldn't worry about it. We have a small class. We can do it in later weeks. And I wouldn't even worry about it until we finish this and two more seminars so that you have a full understanding of the roadmap process to really deconstruct and understand a story and to reconstruct or create a new one. So just, a thought about that. Anything else that any of you would like to talk about?
Hi, this is Stephanie. I'm traveling today, so I'm not going to be saying too much. I just wanted to check in.
Great. I mentioned at the very beginning that you were traveling, probably wouldn't join us unless you were unable to restrain yourself from just popping in at some point. So I'm glad you did. Thanks. Great.
I'm here.
Okay, super. Super. And remember, any of you who have challenges with any of your cases, clients, feel free to use this time. It might be helpful for us to look at anything that you have with clients to use as illustration. If nothing else, I'm going to move into our material then. Final call. Is Anne Marie here? Okay. Recall we looked at the first three steps. Recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines. Today we're going to look at a couple of steps. First step, and this is all in Module 2. You'll see from the outline and the syllabus the corresponding parts of the curriculum. Actually, from the syllabus, you'll see the corresponding part of the curriculum with the content of the seminar. So in step four, next step in this process is decide what to change. So we're going to be talking about choice architecture, specifically about identity choice and the dynamics of mind and brain. So knowing how, in my view, knowing how your minds and brains operate, I think will make you significantly better coaches. Now, a precept for this step, part of the struggle to get people to embrace change is a challenge because many of the methods to facilitate change are often contrary to how the mind and the brain work. So that's why I think it's really important that we devote some time to really understanding the mechanisms, because I think it's going to make a significant difference in what you do. Despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, many people don't make changes even when they know it's in their own best interest. And, you know, as we've talked before, just simply giving information isn't enough. If information were enough, everybody, we would all be thin. We'd have a lot of money saved up for the future. We'd eat mostly vegetables, and we'd work out every day. And most librarians would be billionaires. So information is simply not enough. So here's a brief recap to set the stage for step four. Story is the narrative thread of our experience. Not what literally happens, but what we make of what happens, what we tell ourselves and each other. This becomes what we remember. Wayne and Butch, my two best friends in high school, don't remember my senior prom. They remember theirs. The story tells most about the teller. You make your world fit into the story you're writing. Your story determines your future by predicting it. You write your story, then your story shapes you, determines your relationship with everything. Your present and future story is yours to write. So let's first talk about identity. Your identity is not your behavior or your habits. A habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated, your collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will make it harder to change. I just heard this morning with a client I work with actually twice a week in London, and I asked her why she, even though she recognized she needed to consolidate four different bank accounts into no more than two, I asked her, in knowing that, how do you talk to yourself? What's the conversation that you decide not to follow through on that simple plan? She said, well, I'm stubborn. And I challenged her on that because stubborn is only a descriptor. She's treating it as if it were not only an identity, but as if it were a reason. And I simply indicated that if you relegate an explanation to that category, it's going to seem like an identity, it's going to seem like the way things are, and it's going to make it harder to change. If instead you look at it as a choice in this moment, then you can simply choose what's in your best interest. We listen to other people's stories, how they make up who they are, what they need, including from us, how they teach us to respond to them. People become the stories of who they think they are. She became stubborn. She knew what she needed to do. She knew how to do it. She just didn't do it because that was to remain in her comfort zone so she didn't have to tolerate the anxiety of change. And calling it stubborn made it make sense. It's like a diagnosis. Who can do anything when you've got a diagnosis? The stories usually leave something out, from a blind spot or to even the shadow side of what's wonderful. That something can become an abiding quest, a want or need that can actually define. Remember the equation from last seminar. Belief drives behavior. Behavior drives performance. Here are a couple of examples of basic storylines that show how a belief can lead to behaviors. A wish for approval or acceptance. This can lead to super achievement and benevolent acts. Or it can lead to someone taking too many risks or refusing even to take risks. Or someone never saying no and promising too much and then feeling overwhelmed and depleted. The need for harmony, as another example, can power affiliation and social achievement. It can also make it difficult for people to stand up for themselves when they have a different opinion, or to disregard a need of their own. Remember my client from last session who said yes to everyone else except himself and his self-care. Now, let's talk about choice for a moment. For this step, decide what to change. I want to add an equation. It captures the principle that you either create your reality or agree to it. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in life is the result of how you respond to an event in your life. Achievement is an outcome. It's a result of responding in certain ways. It's not what happens to us, but our response to what happens to us that makes the difference. So if you don't like the outcome you're experiencing, you have two possible things to focus on, either the event or the response. If you focus on the event, you can blame the event. Well, sorry I'm late, the traffic on I-10 was terrible. Or my personal favorite, the assembly instructions just didn't make sense. Or you can focus on the response. You can change your response to the events to get the outcome you want. But you have to give up blaming, complaining, and externalizing. So once more, remember this essential principle for ownership of your life story. In adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. And notice how that makes everything a choice in this moment. The past is history, a memory. The future is an anticipation, a theory. We have only this moment. So it's the choice architecture of this moment that makes difference. And choice is part of a mindset. Now, the antithesis of choice is also a mindset with its own text. This is how that can sound. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I don't think I can do it. The absence of the awareness of choice can limit possibility. Now, here's a sort of footnote. Whatever you're doing that you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, a person, a process, a certain kind of relationship, or even to compromised results. And have you noticed how people specialize? They keep having the same successes or the same problems. If the success is with money and business startups, we see a serial entrepreneur. If the problem is with relationships, that keeps getting repeated. Catherine Ann Porter said, "His mother rejected him. 1,000 women since have paid for that." Here's another notion to consider first for yourself, then you'll recognize it more clearly or readily when you hear it from a client. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that in a slightly different way. Show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter and I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. In other words, in terms of this concept of writing a new story, rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat or surmount an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. The obstacle is there when you create it. It's not when you don't. Consider using your energy to generate something else instead. Another example, a man says, "I only fall for unavailable women." Well, they're unavailable because they already have partners or they're emotionally unavailable. But since he's afraid of women and intimacy, he needed an obstacle to be in place so he could allow himself awareness of his desire. So it's a part of him that's unavailable. Now, there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it seemingly safe to want if you're afraid of it. Here's an example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, "Just let me at him." Now, in the next frame, we saw the cat. The cat was not only not too shabby, but it looked mean and at least as big and as vicious as that dog looked in its biggest snarl. All of a sudden, in the middle of a ferocious bark, the leash snapped, so the dog was free to go after the cat. He looked astonished, scared to death. He ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark as ferocious, "Just let me at him." So, when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, "I can't find time to exercise," reflect on the underlying desire. And here's the coaching principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. So imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. So in this session, we're going to look at what's involved in deciding to change. And then in the next two sessions, we're going to apply it to mapping changes and authoring new experiences. So first, let's look at how the brain opposes change. Because I think this is crucial to understand when we engage change. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. Findings from the cognitive sciences can inform how to change a personal or a business story. So let's look first at how the brain opposes change and then how to use this information to facilitate success. And remember, when you feel with one side of the brain and think on the other, you need a map. Now, since the brain has a mind of its own, we need to consider 10 precepts, 10 principles of how our brains work. Each of these, I believe, will help you in guiding someone to write a new story. The mechanisms are sometimes complex, but the principles are so simple, they're almost elusive. First principle, change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we repeated that have become habits become hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. So what this means, for example, is we don't have to think about how we drive the same way to work each day. It becomes a default mode, and then we can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is also energy efficient, and it makes the brain freed up to do other things. So the brain is amazingly adaptive. It's made routine behaviors energy efficient by creating hardwiring and growing new neurons for that purpose. When these habits are confronted and have to change, though, the basal ganglia, the midbrain where the automatic pilots are, get disrupted, so we feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy and use a lot more energy and attention to process the thinking. So this means it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default habit, or just call yourself stubborn. The brain naturally resists change. To hardwire behavior saves energy, so it opposes what has been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research has shown that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. Ray Kurzweil, one of my favorite authors, said this in the book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. He put it this way, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. Second principle, change creates dissonance. Couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine with the mind's inclination to see what we expect to see. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. We do this by screening information based on expectation as validation. In fact, when people don't see what they expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. Now, this error detection mechanism is located right next to the emotional center of the brain. This is an actual locus in the brain. And the brain has an innate capacity, because of this mechanism, to detect what neuroscientists call errors. meaning the differences between what we expect and what we actually perceive. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right. It can be abrupt and specific. For example, remember the experience maybe of absentmindedly going to the refrigerator and getting a drink of milk just to abruptly discover that it was orange juice. When this happens, neural firings disrupt expected flow and use brain energy. This error detection signal that something is wrong when routine behavior changes means we have to take this coupling into account when we guide and strategize about change with our clients. That something doesn't feel comfortable in the beginning is not an indication to stop. You have to leave your comfort zone to change. So if a client reads the discomfort initially as, well, my gut's telling me that this isn't the right thing, or my intuition says that this is wrong, there's a huge place for intuition and for gut responses, but that's a misread of the initial leaving of a comfort zone and the anxiety because of not knowing what the new and the unfamiliar are like. And to reframe it in that way, as we've talked before, even a validation of progress can be very, very helpful for a client to reframe and to reprogram the model that they're operating on. Now, the good news is the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors, to optimize behavior. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or even diminished reward. So it also responds to mistakes. And that's great if we remember to discern, as we were just talking, whether it's a mistake or a neural response and printout to change itself. 3. The brain is a prediction machine. Let me give you some numbers. If you have a pen, here are the numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? What's your guess about what's missing here? Anyone? 3 and 6, multiples of 3. Consistent. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. Extrapolation has been called the most common mistake in investing, when we predict the future based on the past. J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of many jokes. Listing 2 things, then a 3rd non sequitur. Setup, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So we need to be sure that we predict, that we envision the right things. 4th principle about how to grow sports. Behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say your COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire because studies show 2 things. Threats work short term but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. Remember when we talked about you get what you focus on, not what you want. So the focus in this instance is either on the negative or on avoidance of the negative, which means it's still on the negative because the unconscious doesn't know positive or negative, just the focus. And this is why it's important to be sure people envision the right thing, not just the avoidance of something they don't want, because that's still a focus on the negative and you get what you focus on. Now, we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. Fifth principle, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something and to do it consistently. And someone may not generate motivation until they actually set a goal. But if you think about it, an action can generate its own motivation. Many of the professional athletes I've worked with in coaches and coaching, in the off season, they get up in the morning, they go to the gym, they are not motivated to do that, but they do it because it's what they know they need to do in order to do what's next. So they're not motivated, but they have two things that are essential, a plan and to stick to it. How many times have you heard, and I've heard many times, the coach-to-coach sessions and the CTA training began in some way like this. Well, you know, I just need to get motivated to really be on a diet and to lose weight. Or I need to get motivated to work out every day. Motivation is not necessary. A plan and sticking to it are. If we have time, I'll do an exercise with you that I have done in live groups or presentations at the end to show you that demonstrates how motivation is not necessary. And sixth principle, emotions change brain functioning. Anxiety or fear shifts someone into a survival mode that prevents fluid learning and understanding. The alarm signals of fear, anxiety, anger, even irritability and impatience can shanghai the attention of the frontal lobes and cause them to forfeit their optimum functioning. So when emotions are triggered, brain chemicals are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. And this is one of the reasons that the state change of emotion can be derailing of the balanced decision of left brain and right brain. And this is also why self-talk is limited. You know, change your thoughts to change your behavior may work until emotions get involved. As soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. One of the philosophers of the 21st century put it this way, everybody's got a plan till he gets punched in the mouth. That was Mike Tyson. I didn't say one of the great philosophers. So what happens is that any threat or emotional stress triggers adrenaline and cortisol, the two stress chemicals, and that shifts function away from the brain, away from logic and balanced decision, and more toward action. So it's not even processed through conscious logic and reason. A classic study looked at the correlation of reward and dopamine response. Now, the assumption had been that when anyone, an animal or a person, does something that's a good behavior, the reward is that dopamine is increased, which enhances and reinforces the behavior. Well, this isn't what happened. It's not the reward that causes the spike in dopamine. It's the anticipation of the reward. For example, when gamblers were studied, their excitement occurred as, and they were hooked up to fMRI machine, their excitement, their dopamine spike occurred as they sat down at the slot machine before they ever touched it. Their dopamine spike preceded touching the machine before they were ever rewarded with a win. And this is something that some of you may know. In the 25 years that I practiced psychiatry and psychoanalysis, earlier I had one of the major two or three eating disorder treatment programs in the country back in the early 80s before it was really anybody knew much about it. And of the several hundred people who were bulimic, and I later learned to ask this, at what point do you notice a change in your state of mind when you do a binge, when you engage in eating? Because the theory had always been that people use food as a symbolic nurturing to physiologically regulate and calm, and it works because, you know, of all the physiology involved as well as the psychology involved. 100% of the people, when they really listened to the question and really thought about it, said, before the food ever touches my mouth, it's the state change that anticipates, that precedes. I did a white paper for Chase Bank on the anatomy of the impulse purchase. And this, the same thing happens. Whenever someone anticipates a purchase, they get a dopamine spike. So it's the anticipation rather than the actual purpose that's rewarding, which is why some people fall into the habit of doing shopping whenever they're down or feeling bad or preoccupied, that it's rewarding. And the repetition then becomes habitual, or they become habituated to the response of the dopamine spike as a counter to whatever they're not wanting to feel. So it works for a little while, but never well enough for long enough, so they need to do it again. So seventh principle about how our brains work. And this is about stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us, that provide a little bit of, especially stimulation short term, can enhance learning. But the time window on this is about 2 hours or up to 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, this continued or sustained stimulation can go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means that with sustained stress, people make bad emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy that every executive I've worked with, and I think it will be for most of your clients, the regulation of states of mind and management of emotion is a crucial, essential success strategy. Now, why is this important? Here's an assortment of findings and applications and a brief mention about their source. Stress contributes to 85% of all medical problems, the Cooper Wellness Program. 70 to 80% of physician visits are stress-related, U.S. Public Health Survey. 52% of executives will die of diseases related to stress, Cooper Wellness Program. Stress is the number one reason behind sickness from work, G Publishing Survey. And stress undermines work productivity in 9 of 10 companies, Industrial Society Survey and a UN study. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as being in a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position can get really entrenched. A place, for example, that I see this resistance in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he founded 32 years ago to his two children to own and to manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles and relationships. Now, the last two principles about how the brain works, I think, are really significant, really huge for coaching. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis: enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment is one of intellectual and emotional stimulation, and it creates more complex brain structure. And that's what we do with our clients: co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bust, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And remember, the hippocampus is the site of memory and creativity. Now, another finding: chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. It goes the other direction. The number of cells in the hippocampus decrease with sustained stress. And the 10th principle: neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. An example: for stroke patients who have had a dysfunctional arm, the usual treatment would be to put the affected arm in a sling so further damage doesn't occur. But in some studies that have been replicated, the good arm is put in the sling so that they're forced to use the bad arm to do things like feeding and dressing. After 10 days of therapy, the patient regained significant use of an arm that they thought would otherwise hang useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby brain neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones, neuroplasticity. So another example: not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can be changed depending on its use. For example, an expert Braille reader has significantly greater area handling the finger reading Braille than someone who doesn't. Same for a classical guitarist with a dominant hand. One other finding back to neurogenesis that I didn't mention. I mentioned the 15% increase in the number of hippocampal cells with the enriched environment and almost 100% with exercise. Those findings have recently been replicated in humans in non-invasive studies in University of Hamburg medical students and London taxicab drivers. Now, the good news in this is we are not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways and new neural networks are formed. New highways to new communities in your brain. So, how do we counter the brain resistance to change? Well, first, we can think about reframing the question. How can we best mentor coach someone? These are some things that neuroscience has taught us about mentor coaching. 1, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where you have to begin. You go to where the client is and then go someplace new. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can happen no other way. This was never more succinctly put to me than many, many years ago when I was doing psychoanalysis with a woman executive. I offered an interpretation that I thought was particularly savvy and right on. And her response was one of silence, and I was puzzling about, you know, what was going on. Was she thinking about it? Did it really miss the mark? And then she got up on one elbow and looked back at me. So I knew I was in trouble. She said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." And she was absolutely right. It was a brilliant and succinct summary of a fundamental principle, and this first principle that we're talking about how you have to begin with where someone is. Two, that prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. Neuronal networks are a physical fact in the brain. What this means is that whenever your client knows a fact or has a belief, it's an anatomical reality in their brains. And you can't just present another fact and expect it's going to overwrite the one that's already there, or a new way of looking at things and expect that it's going to suddenly be the one the client adopts. In fact, when you do it this way, their error detection mechanism says that doesn't sound right. That's not the usual way. So this is why we usually don't make a lot of suggestions or try to fix things for clients, but to collaborate and evolve together based on the client's point of reference and where they are at this moment, and then proceed together step by step, create a common ground, and then move ahead. So physical facts, the neuronal networks and pathways in the brain, atrophy with disuse as new networks and pathways take their place. But it's an inside job. I mean, even a teacher intuitively knows that he or she can't present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network from a student's brain. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. So as we mentor and co-create change, we have to start where the client is, not where we are. We can't provide the tools for solving problems before we know what the problems are. That's why fixing usually doesn't work. You can't just list the four reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network. And the error detection mechanism is going to say that doesn't sound right because it doesn't sound usual. Four, partly because it's complex and personal, and partly because it's subjective reality, which is kind of the same thing, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. So prior knowledge is concrete. It's an actual pathway in the brain. So a mentor coach needs to begin with discovering prior knowledge and to begin with the concrete for that client. Specific examples then help someone to become ready for concepts and abstractions and broad principles. So, I want to talk about some specific ways that we can help our clients change their minds and brains, some specific suggestions about things that we can do. But first, I want to pause. Are there any questions or clarifications of anything we've talked about, especially with these 10 principles?
You hear me? You hear me, Dave? Or yeah. Have I gotten mute?
You're good. Go ahead.
Oh, you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I had a question on back to the 10 principles there, and number 8 of which is closure to novelty. Can you say what that is again? Sorry.
Well, whenever someone has done things in a particular way for a period of time, something short term that's done in a repeated way, like driving the same way to work, you don't have to think about it. So you automatically go the same way because you can listen to an audiobook, you can think about things, there's no energy. So going alternate ways, novel approaches, is not something that's a natural quest. They're just, you don't even consider it. But think about somebody who's been in business, in the same business for a couple of decades or more, and they've done things in a particular way. They're well-grooved. They know exactly how it's going to turn out. It's automatic. They're not usually actively perturbating their own system and asking questions about what they could do differently, because they're putting their energy into doing the same thing and making it work. So there's a closure to novelty there. So what we do as coaches is we perturbate a system. We throw a grain of sand into a well-oiled machinery because that well-oiled machinery may have limitations, a glass ceiling, certain compromises, but it's working, but it's not near at optimum performance. But to get to optimum, somebody's going to have to unclose that closed system and tolerate the discomfort of looking at something in new and different ways. So we perturbate the system to disrupt the closure that they've brought about to look at it in a new way, to look at possibilities. That makes sense?
Yes, yes, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very important.
yeah, absolutely. And that's because it's going to be the case with every client you work with, that doing something in a new or different way is going to create difficulty. You can even prescribe it. You know, you can even forecast it to say it's going to create some uncertainty and trepidation to do it in a different way, because that's part of leaving a comfort zone. That's part of doing something when you're unaccustomed or unfamiliar with it, that it won't seem natural because it's not.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Other thoughts or questions?
I have a question about the not trying to fix things.
About
because,
what?
You have said twice, don't try to fix things. Create a common ground to move ahead, but don't try to fix things. And then it says, if you ignore the reality, it's going to get in the way, and fixing doesn't work. So I wanted to know, like, if a client comes to me and says, I need to fix this, because I actually have an artist who's asked me to fix it. And, I mean, according to this, I mean, that's basically taking her power away from herself, right? So she's asking me to make her life the way she wants it instead of her making her life the way she wants it. Is that the right?
Yes. So your question is what specifically?
My question is, how do I'm a natural fixer. This is, like, I guess, my story.
How
so
does
I
that
attract
work for you? When you try to fix things for somebody else, how does that work?
I've been trying to not do this so much lately, but, like, for the project that I'm working on now, I look at what businesses are doing wrong, and I try to fix that, right? So I've taken that tell to the artist, and I realized that, I mean, this was a fairly recent realization, they come from a totally different cultural background than I do. So for me, I'm coming more from an American background, and we don't have so many obstacles when it comes to opportunity. Like, we see an opportunity, and, like, we can do this. Whereas here, they don't have that. This is, like, a big cultural obstacle that I'm seeing. And they are asking, I've had a couple of artists ask me to fix this, and I realized I can't.
What's an example of what they want you to fix? Specifically.
Well, for one of the things that they have an issue with is that, at least for these artists, is here in Germany, they say an artist, there's a cultural idea that an artist must be on Hartz-IV. Hartz-IV is like social welfare, right? So they have this equation that an artist doesn't make money. This is like their ideology here, is a cultural ideology. So, like, this weekend I was at an artist studio, and she told me, she's like, I've asked her to change her term. She says, I need to make more money. I need more money. And I want your help to fix this, right? And I told her that those words weren't the best words to be using, because if she says she needs money, then she will always need money. And then we started talking about some of the things that she's actually doing to try to change that circumstance.
Okay, good.
But this for me is like a major issue, is that I guess I need to deal with this. You're saying not to fix things, but I need to look at how I'm approaching things to make sure that I'm not trying to fix
it. That's a good question. Let me clarify. Initially, when you talked about someone coming with a problem, the usual model of a consultant is to listen to a situation, to hear the problem, and to offer a solution. And
right.
What we do as coaches is quite different in terms of co-creating with our clients and beginning with and staying with the story of the client and not ghostwriting that story and telling them what to do, which is what I mean by trying to fix it, to tell them what they should be doing that's different. But to co-create that and to look at for your client who needs more money, her belief system needs to be fixed. So, you know, if her belief is that artists don't make much money, then that's a belief system that's not going to work it's going to work to get her certain results. So one thing that you – a couple of things that you may want to explore with her. Where ideally would she like to be? What does she see as success? And then once you're both clear about what her goals are and what success is, I'd think about looking what her needs and values are. And if her needs and values are consistent with attaining success, then that can be used as a foundation to change the beliefs that may not be working that say an artist doesn't make much money, because there's nothing inherently true about that. Why should someone of exceptional talent not be able to command an income that's commensurate with that exceptional talent? You know, executives, professional athletes and actors do it all the time. Why not artists? There are professional actors who command exceptional income that's commensurate with their talent. So that belief is not innate, but yet if it is for your client, then part of the request of fixing it is to look at the belief that generates the outcome. To put it in a very simple way, we are basically happy when our blueprint matches our expectations and experiences in life. When our blueprint and our experiences match, we're happy. If we're not happy, one of those two are off, either our blueprint or our experiences. And to get happy, we're going to have to change one or the other. So if the blueprint is what's not working, and if the blueprint says an artist doesn't make much money, I have a glass ceiling, then that blueprint needs to be changed so that the experiences can be changed. So that's where you have your, and it's a very coachable issue. And we'll talk more about that as we get to money story, but it's you know, the belief generates the behavior, and the behavior generates the performance. So that little equation sounds like it may be especially helpful for your work with that client. Does that make sense
okay.
to you about a way of exploring that with your client?
Yeah, I just, I'm just, because it's a cultural thing, and these people are subconsciously, like she has never told me that artists should be in Heart Sphere, because she's not.
Well,
but,
I think it's a subculture of artists, about starving artists. I don't think it has as much to do with Germany versus stateside as you do, but if it's
yeah.
a belief system, whatever the origins are, it's still a belief system, and beliefs can change. Beliefs are a construction of this moment. So I would treat it in that way, not explaining it or relegating it to the culture any more than my client tried to relegate it to stubbornness, as if that were a causal explanation, as if that were a
okay.
sufficient explanation. And then exploration of it is stopped. If you attribute it to a culture, well, that's the way it is. You're going to stop. So Your challenge is to perturbate the belief system, whatever the origins are.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yep.
Great.
Thank you.
Let's follow up on that and see where you get to with it, because I know you do a good deal of work with artists.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So just a little bit more material I want to cover. Some specific ways that we can help our clients change their minds and brains. One. Begin with client is. You have a better chance of connecting with the neural networks of your clients if you use concrete examples they already know, their own experiences. And no one can understand something that's unconnected, at least in some way, to existing knowledge. So we begin where the client is. Two, help them learn more about what they already know. To mentor coach in any way, we have to begin where someone is, their existing neural networks. So a simple way to begin is for someone to describe this experience and ideas about whatever the subject is. You're going to hear limiting assumptions or beliefs in that description. Three, highlight positive attributes, existing neural networks like natural talents, behaviors, patterns to encourage their practice. Four, don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. Five, correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Six, let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lie. In other words, it won't help, it will detract if you try to explore why a mistaken belief came into existence. Seven, encourage the clients to develop their own metaphors, stories, and connections, because stories, analogies, metaphors, create maps. To set the stage, engage people to explore possibilities outside their expectations, to look at things differently. Remember Ben Fletcher's study at the University of Hertfordshire to engage volunteers to do things differently, to be conscious of choice, to act on it, and then to see changes. And eight, the brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations and connections. Here's the amazing paradox of the brain. While the brain pushes back like a two-year-old against new or different information and patterns, the error detection mechanism, it's an organ of homeostasis with tracks laid down that we call habits, it also has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations. Now, how does this work? When someone solves a problem or has an aha experience or an insight, adrenaline is released. Three different parts of the brain light up with an insight or an aha experience that creates a vaulting to a new and different state of mind that is more synthetic and integrative and creative. So there's an immediate inclination to further creativity. This is why, as coaches, we ask questions and co-create innovative ideas rather than providing answers or solutions. Nine, you have to recognize and take ownership of your experience. You won't believe things to be different just because you're told or because it's a theory. You have to act on it, to put it into action. And ten, when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Here's just a quick study. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that absolutely reversed the images. Down was up, up was down. So they consistently had to be very careful and think through every move that they made because they were in this headgear 24 hours a day. So they adjusted everything. Then, about day 25, they noticed something really remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had rewired, had developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of the helmets at day 15 for 24 hours. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on for their brains to rewire. And this is to emphasize the role of consistency in making change. changes. And number 11, give attention to a new experience, a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. This follows from the NASA example. What we do in mentor coaching is meeting usually weekly with our clients to offer small amounts of information and a consistent focus on change. This process yields better learning than a one-time intensive training unless they're follow-up programs. Let me give you an example. Some penguins who wanted to learn to fly got together and hired a coach. They did an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals, visualized, wrote affirmations. After a few hours, one penguin had a breakthrough and flew a short distance. Then others were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. So other thoughts or clarifications or questions about any of this? Remember that some change occurs from the inside out, from examining and altering thoughts and feelings, and the result is behavior change. Some change occurs from the outside in, when situations or experiences are there and people have to adapt to it, to events like divorce, job change, death, a number of things. We then react to change and go through the developmental stages of change and transformation in this way. Thoughts or questions?
Yeah, I think when you were mentioning number 10, I got really excited about that. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. So it's very helpful.
Yeah, exactly. And there's the inherent stimulation and reward of that you know, the brain reacts with release of new chemicals, inducing a different state of mind, different parts of the brain light up. Consider what happens. You know, we see a cross-section of the brain, three different parts light up with an aha or moment of insight. Consider the same situation, except that we give information, we present a fact, we have directives or an order. No part of the brain lights up. Nothing happens. So it's a huge difference in terms of what innately creates intrinsic desire in co-creating a new story that furthers that story and furthers the engagement in doing that, both internally and between two people, the catalyst, us, the mentor coach, and the client. Other thoughts or questions?
Is it the 25 days to rewire for the astronauts, is that like typical? Because you usually hear like, you know, 30 days to create a new habit or whatever. Is that 25 days? So if people ask how long is it going to take, you said consistency, so they have to continue doing it. Otherwise, the neural pathway, does that take 25 days for it to come into existence, or is there?
Usually it takes somewhere between 21 and 30 days to change pathways to make them relatively stable, and there's not a set rule, but it's somewhere in that when it's done daily, when it's practiced regularly, things began to become a habit at around a month or so. Now there are other more complex behavior patterns that are more interactive. And behavior patterns like attachment patterns that aren't just simply a stimulus and response. Now, these take longer. These may take several months, but the good news there is that if you revert back, you want to recognize it as soon as possible and resume doing things a new way, and it's not like starting over at day one like the astronauts. So it's just a matter of early recognition, like an interactive or an attachment pattern with a family member, to recognize it, recognize the cue or the trigger that creates a state change, and then get grounded and centered and have an ideal. We'll talk about this, and I have a little system for doing this that I mentioned as we get to state changes. But there can be a systematic approach that can make the change optimum within a period of time. So for some things, yeah, a month will be enough. For some things, longer, but it's, you know, it's for more complex patterns that it takes that.
With the wellness, because I deal a lot with that, is the wellness, like with your eating habits and all that, would that be considered the simpler one than the 30-day?
Well, wellness is an abstraction. It's an epiphenomenon. Okay. So if you're talking about an eating habit, I'm not sure when you say it. What do you mean by an eating habit? That doesn't take, you know, if your commitment is to not eat cheesecake, even with strawberry topping, that doesn't take 30 days. That's a decision you make each moment. So give me an example of something you want to develop into a habit. Or let me give you an example. And I'll talk about this some as we get to the wellness. One of the people who's become a collaborator whose work I got to know and knew, came to know some of my work, we read each other when we shared a venue, a presentation, is Dr. Henry Lodge, Jr., who wrote Younger Next Year. Now, before I read his work and became, he's devoted 35 years of his professional life as an internist in New York City to wellness research. And he presents in very compelling ways how when we work out 6 days a week, after, at least beginning at age 50, that 70% of aging is not aging but decay. And he has some tremendous statistics about working out on a regular basis and working out physically 6 days a week. Now, I had worked out 3 or 4 days a week, but when I got familiar with his work, I do that on a regular basis. Now, it's not something I find time for, I work in at the end of the day. It's something I create on my schedule as a certain part of every day at a particular time period. So it's become a habit. It's not something I do if I have time. It's just something I do. It's like the appointment that we keep at the top of this hour when we do the seminar. It's something I regularly do. Now, if I don't do it, something's not right. So it's become a habit. It's become a routine. It's become part of my schedule. So that's one way to think about it, is just to make it something that you do. And then it will become natural, and you probably won't even consider not doing it because it doesn't feel right. And so I hope that makes sense. I know we're a couple of minutes over. So let's come back to that and revisit that, because I think it's a really good question. So thanks very much. Look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Have a great rest of the week. See you next time.
Thank you.
See you.